So far, so good.
The voice you guys hear in this recording booth is none other than filmmaker Jack Bennett, whose credits include the Anthrax music video Blood Eagle Wings, contributing for the books The Damn Dirty Geeks Talk Among Us,
yes, and
My Favorite Horror Movie, yes, as well as helming. Yeah, and Helmet. He has guested and provided numerous voices for Earbud Theater and the MST3K Revival League, as well as helming the best documentary on a cult film of all time known as Never Surrender, about Galaxy Quest.
Never Surrender, a Galaxy Quest documentary. Mm-hmm. I wonder what that movie's about. Well,
I still can't believe you opened up with a David Mamet quote, because I had no idea prior to that. I'm like, Mamet likes sci-fi? The nerve.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because that, I love Mamet. They open with that in the cut that was released, but we actually had in my cut, we actually had that get led up to a moment when Mark Johnson holds up his book. Because he has this book of photos, and in the book is the David Mamet quote. So Mark Johnson actually shared that quote with us, because Mamet put that in there in one of his books.
That's right. It was in an earlier book, but I, you know.
Yeah. It was
in a post Kindle age. I'm not sure who would have known about it unless they were had followed him since the beginning of time, you know.
For sure. Yeah. I think he says Dodsworth, The Godfather, A Place in the Sun, and Galaxy Quest. These are four perfect films.
The most, and all those movies are like anti-movie, because like they are all putting the genre, just like we were talking about on our RoboCop episode, we were talking about genre cliches put to the side. I mean, here we're talking about our favorite moments from the Child's Play franchise.
Sure.
Chucky is both a godfather of killer doll movies, as well as one that kind of just also goes in directions. Like, was he kind of one of your first horror comedies that you knew growing up? I was a Gremlins guy growing up, but I came into these much later. Like, I had seen more of Puppet Master growing up than I had of any Child's Play.
Yeah.
How about you?
I didn't hear a word you said, because I was just thinking about when I told Sam Rockwell that David Mamet quote, and I was just reliving in my mind. I was just remembering that I was in a hotel room in the village. And we're filming with Sam, and I told Sam that quote, because Sam had worked with David Mamet.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
He had worked with David Mamet on Heist. He's in Heist.
Yes,
and there's actually a similar look with the dark hair and the mustache and everything. And I remember saying to Sam, so I just, you know, want to quote David Mamet. And, you know, I told him the quote, and that's what's in the movie, is Sam going, David Mamet said that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, just how much is in that, how much is in Sam's reaction in that moment. Like, I only got to talk to the guy for about an hour, but there's still that quality of like, I could have followed up on literally everything we talked about, and I hope I get the opportunity.
You need to, dude. You absolutely need to.
All the stuff that he said about Chris Walken, all the stuff that he said about David Mamet, everything. It was just and by the way, Sam Rockwell is exactly what you hope Sam Rockwell is like. He comes absolutely in such a great guy and such a Sam Rockwell character, like from the moment you started talking to him.
He's all man.
he's a safe man.
He's all sci-fi.
All right, stop, edit point, and
edit
then
point, cut to commercial.
In answer to your question,
yes,
was Chucky one of my first guys? You know, it's funny. I was scared of horror movies when I was a kid. That was because I hadn't seen any. So I would see
afraid of the posts. Unknown.
Yeah, afraid of the unknown. But also, I had such an active imagination. I would hear what happens in a horror movie, and I would imagine it so vividly. And that vividness, it just felt like watching a horror movie would be like being stuck in a nightmare. So I didn't really have any exposure to them. And then also my older brother could clear me from a room by saying, Jack, you can't watch this movie. It's scary. And I'd go, I'd run out of the room, and then he would watch 2010, you know, the
most on scary movie ever.
Yeah, exactly. And so there was something about how what I imagined it to be, I think, was just the effect. It would be the effect of having a nightmare. And I was still a little kid having nightmares. And then one day I get up before the rest of my family, and I turn on the TV, and I turn it to HBO. I wasn't allowed to watch TV during the week. So on Saturday mornings, I got to watch Saturday morning cartoons. So I would get up earlier. Yeah. So I'd get up earlier and earlier to catch more and more cartoons. And I would come downstairs and turn on the TV. And when there were no cartoons, because it was too early, I turned to HBO and it was Fraggle Rock. And it's like, so I'm watching Fraggle Rock at 7 o'clock in the morning on Saturday mornings. And then one day I get up at 6:30 and it's whatever was before Fraggle Rock. It was this little cartoon called Brain Games, you know, it says, Brain Games is now over. And it was just like a little interstitial. And then one day I got up so early that it was the last 20 minutes of Return of the Living Dead.
Oh, wow.
Because HBO would show their last R-rated movie. I think it had to be
by
done
five.
By, done by 6 a.m. So if I got up at 5:30, I saw the last 20 minutes of Return of the Living Dead. I saw the ending of that movie before I saw
it. That's the way you want to do it, man. You start off with Skinamax and cult horror movies, and then you start your day off with Jim Henson Hour, and then you end the day with Sopranos whacking someone. You know,
and this would be the mid-80s of HBO. So the horror movies that I would see, because then I started doing it on purpose. Like my folks get up at 7 a.m. and say, what is he watching? Oh, Fraggle Rock. Great. Because, you know, they hear the nuclear explosion from the TV set. They come downstairs and they're like, okay, yeah, he's fine. And not paying attention to the fact that my brain has been completely evaporated and turned into a new brain because I just
brains.
Saw
yeah.
Yep. So I started doing that on purpose and I started watching the most I could of the last movie HBO would show before it turned to kids programming. And eventually I got up so early that I'm catching the entire movie. And the last movie of their R-rated programming would always be like a gnarly horror movie on the East Coast. So I'm watching Fright Night. I'm watching Reanimator. I'm watching Evil Dead 2. And my younger brother started getting up with me. And then suddenly, like, I'm, you know, 10 and he's 7 and we're watching, you know, before my parents wake up, we're like sneaking in like a mid-80s, you know, crazy ass horror
movie. You won't snitch, will you? You better not.
Yeah. And Ted, my younger brother, Ted, was all, like, he took to it, you know, faster than I did, really. And
sweet.
What ended up happening,
like,
because of that, I was watching these gnarly horror movies, and then the really popular ones became more like pop culture figures than they did like honest to God horror movies. And so it became that thing of Freddy was everywhere. He was on every poster for Freddy's Revenge for Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Cougar. Yep.
So I would see his face everywhere. And then what would happen is that was a scary face and that was like haunting my nightmares. And then cut to a scant 5 years later, and he's, you know, he might as well have been Don Rickles, you know, and be like, oh, let's go see Freddy. Because I felt like I was already becoming a horror snob by the time four and five were coming out. So basically I was raised on that stuff, but I do remember that it was kind of a weird mixed bag because it was what was available to us because I couldn't go to the video store on my own yet. Right. So I would watch the Friday the 13th marathon on Fox with all of the.
There you go. It was on every channel, dude. TNT, yeah. UPN. Yeah. I remember Spike TV was still doing it in the 2000s. And I couldn't believe it.
Oh, my God. So when I finally got to rent Friday the 13th part two when I was a teenager and I got to see all the parts they snipped out, like the girl going skinny dipping or the you know, or the guy getting the machete in his face, you know, all that kind of stuff.
It always blows your mind. And I'm sure you love it as an editor yourself because this is like, just take 5 seconds away. It's like they do with every other movie. It's like every gunshot is still exciting. It just doesn't have the gory, you know, windshield blood spray, you know, you just see
maniac. I think that there was also almost like they provided a service by making it so
accessible.
I was gonna say by being so awkward with the cuts because you could something was missing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that created I wonder what
commercial, what happened to the skinny dipping gal? Oh
yeah, or even I remember very vividly the first Friday the 13th when it's one of the Morgans. It's somebody I actually know her family, but the first victim, the throat slice. Oh, I just hit my microphone. The throat slice victim in the beginning of Friday the 13th.
Chucky's hitting his mic here, everybody.
So I do remember that the advertising for Child's Play was not revealing that Chucky was doing the murders. It was him in silhouette, and there was mm-hmm. even a bit of a suggestion that maybe it was the kid dressed up as Chucky.
Oh, nice.
So when I finally saw Child's Play, let me see what year. So that was 88. Okay, so I would have been 10, and I remember seeing Child's Play, I think at Beacon Hill in the Dollar Theater, and I went and saw it, and when Chucky goes, "Yo, stupid bitch," and the reveal that he's alive with no batteries in him, the audience,
he's trying to give the people in pieces a run for their money with his use of the word bitch.
Bastard. We were watching that recently, and my girlfriend hadn't seen it yet, and we were watching it, and she screams, "Bastard!" Pause, breath, "Bastard!" Pause. And Liesl, my girlfriend, says, "Is she gonna go for a third one?" Bastard! It's like, yes.
Oh my god! Everyone's being told this direction, and they're not realizing how repetitive it is until they get to the editing room. It's like, you realize this is in the script 5 different times.
For sure. And
just like on Temple of Doom.
No cut. I haven't heard cut yet. I'll just keep yelling bastard.
Like at Temple of Doom, where Kid Capshaw, your motivation, scream, and keep screaming, scream louder,
and then whine.
And then whine, don't kill me, man.
She's got a lot of charisma in that movie, but boy, oh boy, does that reveal how Lucas and Spielberg were not in a, shall we say, feminist place when they created that character. So,
and it's okay, because everyone likes it. Somehow is like, I'm convinced. It reminds me of that Funny or Die article where they're like, "I'm Tom Hanks, and if I told you I killed someone, you would still like me."
Yeah, well, I'm not going to take that bait because
I know it's just funny because it's almost is a borderline Prince or William Shatner thing where it's like somehow, despite them being a dick, somehow people are used to their shameless nature. So there's like, okay, I guess.
Well, we pick and choose, don't we? It's because
we really do.
I think it's everybody's got an internal barometer for that kind of stuff. And so
they
does
their limit. Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like the idea of being quote unquote canceled is just how many people don't like you anymore.
There's and that versus how much we've expected it versus it's a long time coming. Long overdue. Well,
and then, or people talk about that all the time about how Richard Pryor had all of these problems that he was very open about. And therefore, mm-hmm. even though he engaged despicable behavior, there was some part of, but we learned about that from him and we heard his, we could see how vulnerable he was and all this sort of stuff. If you really think about it, he did some really horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Cosby was our dad. And then one day it turns out that our dad was a despicable human being.
Lied to us for 40 years.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like you think about that stuff and it's very hard to determine what you're going to react to emotionally. Because there are some actors who I can still watch even though they've had public troubles or even, watching movies made by people who have turned out to be destructive people and horrible, toxic people.
Oh, there's movies and shows. I'm glad I saw it when I did because I'm not sure I could watch them now.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, and then there are things that even unexpectedly I have a hard time watching now. Like even going in, I'm like, oh god, like I can't separate the reality from the fantasy anymore.
Law and Order did pretty good. There's only like 5 episodes where I'm like, and that guy is an actual real life rapist in real life, so I can't watch it.
God, which one?
Oh, there was Jeffrey Tambor was a sexual harasser, and then there was what's his name, Collins from Seventh Heaven.
Oh yeah, that's
motion picture.
Yeah,
I didn't like the episode, but I was like, but I especially am going to skip it just because I know he's a shitbag in real life.
But that's a rough one too because he's the new captain in Star Trek: The Motion Picture, which mm-hmm. is a movie that I've definitely defended throughout the years of like, no, that's actually kind of the most Star Trek of all the Star Trek movies. And then every time he shows up, you're like, it's that guy again. But but it's an internal barometer, and I'm not going to tell anybody what to think or what to feel. And it's like, if you think you feel it, think it, feel it, say it, whatever you want to do. I have my own set of rules and they evolve, so it's like
we all want the same thing, but we just don't know how to internalize it. Like you say, it's just kind of like okay, but like you say, you don't want to gatekeep, and at the same time you do want to critique with when you're ready to, as opposed to prematurely, like, well, we don't know all the evidence, or maybe they're it could be like the Caine Mutiny, where they're shitty, but they're not awful, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and,
like,
who's worse than the Caine Mutiny? Captain Queeg, or that guy who manipulated the mutiny? Not the guy who called mutiny, but the guy who was manipulating him to call mutiny. Mm-hmm. It's like, which is worse, the manipulator or the guy who's clearly mentally ill? Captain Queeg is clearly mentally ill.
Absolutely. Anyway, so, do you want the manager who's bad at answering your emails, or the assistant who's cutting some corners?
Yeah, I mean, it's all case by case, and it's all, we just gotta stay open-minded. Yesterday's virtuous is today's outdated. You know, I remember,
yes.
I remember when the Jonathan Demme movie Philadelphia came out, and people thought of it as a win, and today people talk about it as, boy, these two straight guys playing gay guys, and they never even kiss, you know, like all that kind of stuff. Or The Birdcage, you know, a popular comedy that changed people's minds about something that at the time was a really hard subject, that today that's no longer a hard subject. It's more of a duh. Yeah, of course, gay people are people. You know, a lot of people think that. I know that there are some people that do not. And but then it's like, it comes fully around, where then suddenly a movie like The Birdcage almost seems like a minstrel show, you know, where it's like, that was a movie that changed minds when it came out in the 90s. And today you look at it and it's like,
it's a funny movie, but yeah, it's,
I love it. I will watch that movie every week. But also, if you look at that movie and call boo on it, boo away, you know, like that is
kind of like half the war history movies. I see people being blown away, no pun intended, by some of these new ones. I'm like, it's really no different than an episode of Gunsmoke or Combat, you know, that I've already grown up seeing, you know?
Going back in time and watching, you know, half of the Sidney Poitier movies that made him a movie star, you know, like he's such an elegant, charismatic, incredible actor. And every time he shows up in a movie, you're like, oh wow, he is a star. And then the context of the scenes he has to play, you know, and you look at that and you're just like, yesterday's virtuous is today's outdated.
And how they even got made back then.
Yeah, for sure.
It's almost like with half the different movies you have now, it's like some of them are bigoted producers who aren't.
Right.
Or execs who don't really understand it, but just want easy ratings. And then there's other ones who are like, I like the idea and progressive nature, I just don't think it'll make money. And it's like, well, wrong you are. This will totally make money.
Yeah. I don't have, like, the most controversial opinions that I have tend to be things like, that movie that everybody likes, I tend to think is a bad movie, you know, shit like that. Because I don't come from a famine mentality. I come from a mentality that there's enough for all of us. And I do want to see.
I let the hype die down, man. Sure.
I want to see all kinds of movies.
There's going to be 500 clickbait articles saying everything right or everything wrong about this movie, right? And you're like, yeah, well, it does. If you need to go to any of these clickbait things just to form your own opinion, you're probably already not ready to have this conversation. You're just looking for easy, just, you know, sure, boxing matches.
But I'm not gonna shit on what anybody's interpretation of things are, because I do think that it is. What anybody has to say is valid, and what you choose to accept or reject is also valid. And there's validity in just, we have to create our own moral space that we exist in, and you find other people that share your values. And that's, you know, I don't think of it in terms of tribalism, where circle the wagons and protect yourself from all the outsiders. I do think that there needs to be harmony and consensus, but I also believe that, you know, I was somebody who was more progressive growing up in a red state. So I was like, Virginia was a red state when I lived there. Mm. And so I lived side by side with many people who disagreed with me all the time. And I think that there's
pretty hard to do. State.
Well, no, it's not. Yeah. It really wasn't. Yeah. And maybe it's gotten harder, but I do, because a discourse is something that people are interested in less and less. But I do think that there's something to be said for when you grow up in a situation where people don't have the same views, but have to get along, because if they don't, the factory closes, you know?
Yes.
It's like you learn, and then even talking about, you know, working with police or people in the military, or, you know, there are things where you're in a platoon and you're in a squad and you have to, everybody's got a common
Jack,
goal.
Would you commit some war crimes for me, baby?
Yeah, I never had to do that, thank goodness. But then
this
that's
is
also
not Casualties of War or The Deer Hunter, I swear.
Yay. I mean, you do wonder how you would act in those situations. And that's why I find movies so important, because they become
that's
like
why I like gangster movies too. Sure. I mean, you have a tolerance factor of okay, the film, kind of like we were talking about Verhoeven the other day, is like, yeah. Okay, they're trying to see how they can get to you. And if you're bothered, that's a good thing versus, okay, right. This movie knows what it wants to be, but it's not doing it the right way. Like, Roland Emmerich wants to make an important movie. He doesn't know how to make an important movie. So
well, and then Roland Emmerich could point to the box office grosses and say, it's that important, damn it. You know, and,
right?
And then that's just a way of looking at it.
Money,
you know?
Just backs everything up after a while, and it all trickles around.
And
Roger
like
Ebert
about,
was one of the few critics you can't buy. He would say, it's not a good movie, but it's an entertaining movie. 3 out of 4 stars.
And he was one of my favorite critics. And boy, oh boy, did I disagree with him on so many movies. He gave one star to Blue Velvet. He gave 1.5 stars to Raising Arizona. Those are two of my favorite movies. And like the list goes on and on. It's like he gave 3 stars to the remake of The Haunting. And he based his review of being positive on the production design. He was like, it's a great house, 3 stars. And you're like, what the hell is wrong with you, Roger? But he was also, you know,
he liked Seagal, but hated Van Damme. You know, it's everything, man. I mean,
yeah,
he was.
I liked Seagal back in the day. I liked those. I liked the Buffalo.
Oh, we all did, because we were like, yeah. Hey, he's cool. And just showed you how. We had Baywatch logic. We just thought, hey, this is how everything works. It's like, that's not how it works.
If it hadn't been for Under Siege, we wouldn't have gotten The Fugitive with Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones.
That's the other thing you got to look at, too, is like half these movies, you may hate them. Is like, thank the God for, if you want to praise Tarantino, thank God there was Grindhouse movies, because then you wouldn't have had Tarantino. But
and that's what it is. When you really comes down to it, it really is what I was saying before about the channels. The channels being like there's an inlet, there's a sound, and then you can follow these channels, and you go down the channel that you like, and that's the channel you swim. And I don't think that means block out the stuff you don't like, because we should be sampling all kinds of things. We should be seeing if we like all kinds of things. But if you don't like it, you don't have to like it. You know, nobody should feel pressured to follow what the group thinks is.
That's a good segue here. There's going to be a bunch of sequels and spinoffs of this whole Chucky franchise that
you
love or hate, but it doesn't matter, because like it's one of the rare ones that you kind of respect. It's not like, hey, I disown this one Star Wars movie or Jurassic Park sequel that went too far, or Saw or Fast and Furious, where it's a shadow of its former self, for better or worse. And now with Chucky, it always knew what it wanted to be. It just was a matter of whether you liked it, I guess.
Yeah, but I'll say this. since Don Mancini sort of took over the creative direction of it, there's been more of a consistent direction. And before that moment, which I think you can call Bride of Chucky, even though he wrote all of them, before that moment, it did kind of have a shaky liftoff. And it's a great first movie. And then you have 2 movies that are kind of trying to replicate the success of that first movie.
But they're better than the RoboCop ones, in that they don't have to try and juggle satire.
Well, you asked me before if he was an early one for me. And I think when I was a kid, he didn't speak to me. And I think that it was...
We'd seen too much of similar stuff.
Yeah, it was a little... He was sort of the silly one. You know,
you weren't watching this. You were watching The Howling. You were watching...
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Plenty of other ones.
I was already watching... The Thing, The Fly,
The Fly,
American Werewolf in London, and you know, I was already watching the stuff that was kind of before my time. So because
you mentioned Reanimator, there's another one, you know.
Yeah, Reanimator.
All those other Evil Dead-esque horror comedies that would have some sci-fi exposition and even some action to finish it up. And I would argue
that Reanimator is not a comedy any more than like Bride of Frankenstein's a comedy. It's But I would also argue that Shaun of the Dead is not necessarily a comedy. It's a horror movie that's just really funny. It has a lot of comedy in it. And I
kind of like Jurassic Park, kind of.
Well, yeah, sure. They're like Jeff Goldblum.
It's like there's comedic dialogue, but it's not.
Yeah.
like you say, it's not a horror comedy. It's just
and then the difference between comic relief
like Die Hard.
And comedy.
It's a very funny movie, but it's not an action comedy.
And some of my favorite dramas are hilarious. Like that's the thing of like if you I just feel like that's the reason why I love horror as a genre so much. It's that it's a giant umbrella and you can put almost anything underneath.
So many elements, so much commentary like we talked about before. Yeah. And
so the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a horror movie. And Shaun of the Dead is also a horror movie. And Cronenberg movies, you know, Videodrome is a horror movie. And The Brood is a horror movie. Mm-hmm. And Don't Look Now is a horror movie. And Juan of the Dead is a horror movie. And Last Train to Busan is a horror movie.
Yes.
And, you know, all the J-horror stuff, all of, you know, Audition is a horror movie.
Every other giallo supernatural Italian drama is like, Argento has moments that have come off as unintentionally funny, but they've added to his mind-blowing plot twists and unforgettable style. So and
yes,
so now that you've seen all these movies emulate each other, you're wondering who is the main king, or are they all part of the same food chain?
If you compare Dawn of the Dead to Shaun of the Dead, like, are there more comedy bits in Shaun of the Dead than in Dawn of the Dead? And of course I think the answer is yes, but then by the end of Shaun of the Dead, there's no comedy. Like there's something you said for, I have a dear friend who was giving my girlfriend and I basically a class in romantic comedies. And that's because my girlfriend and I are huge genre fans and have never really, like the one genre we've never really engaged in is romantic comedies. And is your future so bright you had to put on shades?
This is nighttime glasses I use to remove junk light, make me sleep better. But it's all good.
Yeah,
you can, for those who can't see, they're wondering why I'm doing a CSI. I'm putting on the glasses.
I thought you were making a dream a little dream reference. I thought you started saying romantic comedies and you referenced a terrible one. No, anyway,
I wear my sunglasses at night, baby. So
you're
learning about romantic comedy
specifically, because we're giant horror nerds. We're giant comedy.
Chucky is totally a romantic drama. Yep.
Well, and the thing is, my friend said, what's the difference between Shakespeare's tragedies and Shakespeare's comedies? And the answer is, the tragedies end with the funeral, you know, with a death. The comedies end with the wedding, with life. And that's the difference. Her name is Jess Lorton. I just want to call her out, Jess Lorton. She's a genius. So the
brilliant, I tell you.
But that's the thing. If you look at Shaun of the Dead, there's a nice kind of happy ending, but to get to the happy ending, you have to go through all this misery. I would kind of argue it's more of a zombie movie than it is a comedy. I would argue that it's more an actual zombie movie than it is a satire of them. And I'm wrong. So when you get to
what is right anymore, my dude?
I mean, I don't know. Why is that the why you had me on this
right
podcast?
Is wrong,
I
can't right is wrong. Answer.
Right. Yeah. Down is up, cats are dogs.
I hate the Chucky TV show, but many people love it. So
do you not like it?
I can't get into it at all. I just find
where'd you stop?
I saw the whole season one and was just like, these kids can't act their way out of a sandbox. And the CGI
CGI was
pretty cruel, but I get it.
I get you with the CGI blood. I get you with the CGI gore.
I just don't.
That's a bummer.
I just feels like one of those lesser Puppet Master movies where they're reusing a lot of footage and it wasn't to me like Ash versus Evil Dead, where each season is re-examining each installment in the movie and getting some closure while doing, and then the last 20 minutes, much like Shaun of the Dead, are giving you all the gory goodness that all the hounds came for. But
well, let me tell you,
more power to them all. People are talking about the police disarming fight that's kind of crazy in the first season.
Mm. Let me give you my Chucky theory. I think that Don Mancini has found a wonderful clothesline to hang so much of what he's really interested in.
Oh, yeah, I love him. Still a fan.
and part of that clothesline is what my another brilliant friend named Jesse, my friend Jesse Merlin, he told me it's not hagsploitation, it's psychobiddy. So psychobiddy. So the fact that... the fact that Jennifer Tilly is full on like embracing her Joan Crawford in William Castle movies kind of aspect of her career. And she's doing it with such skill and she's so funny and she's so good And Fiona Dorff is so good. And it's like, you find these things that should be campy, but since they're infusing them with such a lusty kind of like a bloodlust,
it
has become this thing that should be camp, and it would be camp if it wasn't so misanthropic. So it's a little campy and it's a little misanthropic. And that to me is Chucky in a nutshell. Rewatching all of those movies, because I did that recently, because Chucky kind of went from being a guy I wasn't too into to maybe my favorite slasher. Oh, and sweet. The reason is because he's a great character. That character can't keep his shit together for more than 5 seconds without exploding into a murderous rage. He's not playing that. The long game in all these movies where he's like, I'm going to pretend I'm a doll. And then when he gets caught, it's like, Andy, let me out of the closet. Remember, we're friends. I'm not going to hurt you. Let me out of this fucking closet. I'll fucking kill you.
And it's schizophrenic almost. But it's funny.
He's just so full of rage. Like, even the way he just, like in Chucky, in a Child's Play 2, there's a moment where he's in the car and he's got the gun on the driver and he says, pull this piece of shit over. It's like, pull over and park this piece
all
of
over.
Shit.
Yeah.
It's like, he's just full of hate. He hates everything. He hates that guy's perfectly normal car, you know?
Anyone else, it would just feel generic, and somehow he makes it feel...
Because it's Brad Dourif. Brad Dourif is such a good actor. He's such a good actor.
From Cuckoo's Nest to this. It's awesome.
Oh, Oscar nominee from Cuckoo's Nest, and just a guy who can show up in dramas and exploitation movies, and he's always great. And
he's got a great resume.
A great resume. Like a guy who, he's in one of the most popular film trilogies of all time, The Lord of the Rings, right?
Yep.
And then he's also in like Rolf Kineski's movie, The Hazing, you know?
He's
in Graveyard Shift, you know? He's in crap. Kineski's he's in crappy so underrated. Movies.
But yeah.
And he's in Blue Velvet. He's in fucking Blue Velvet.
I forgot he was in that. Wise Blood, and obviously part of the Star Trek and Deadwood family. So there you go.
Oh, Deadwood. And he's such a terrific actor. He finds a way.
Heart to everybody.
And just like that thing we were talking about in the RoboCop thing about Kurtwood Smith, he finds that way to have everything be convincing, but also layered. He finds layers in even a generic bad guy line. And he finds the time to be delicate and the time to be soft and the time to be a little whimsical. And then in the seat of Chucky, possibly the series nadir, a lot of people say that's the worst movie. In the seat of Chucky, you've got my favorite moment in the whole series, which
is favorite.
Oh my God. When Chucky says, wait a second, I'm so sick of you poisoning our child's mind with the idea that murder is bad. I love murder. I'm proud of it. I'm good at it. You know, like this whole, he gives this impassioned defense of murder. And you're like, he loves killing people.
Murder at 10. Yeah. He doesn't get off on it. He just loves doing it.
Yeah. And in the way that Freddie went from being scary to kind of being a guy like an insult comic, like Freddie, you know, Robert Englund is a terrific actor too, but Freddie, Freddie doesn't have that quality that makes us.
He's only as good as the movie he's in, even though he's given it 100.
That's
every
a good
movie.
Point to make. That's a but, good point.
Yeah. Chucky is kind of like Brad Dourif is self-aware, even if the movie isn't. I think that's the power.
Well, and also Brad Dourif shows up. He's never just collected a paycheck.
Yeah.
And Mark Hamill is an equally good actor and an incredible voice actor. And there's just nothing to his Chucky when they remade it.
He was given it. And yet it just didn't. You want to talk execution? That was a perfect example where I was just like, why did they bother?
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, it's Brent Pope, the host of Breakfast with Brent Pope. You've seen me on some of your favorite TV shows saying things like, give it up, Jimmy. You got to sink this putt to win. On Breakfast with Brent Pope, I sit down with guests from the entertainment world and we do it all over breakfast. Or should I say Breakfast? Every week on Breakfast, you get inside Hollywood info and tips, great breakfast recs and booty debates. Most of all, you get the most delightful 30 minutes of your week. So dig in. It's Breakfast time. Listen at Breakfast.com, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
I don't blame Mark Hamill at all for that, but it is, I'll tell you why they bothered, and I'm making the slippery money fingers.
Yeah.
The money. Where's the
even
money?
The score by Bear McQuarrie really let me down, and it's a shame because I know he's...
Oh, he's such a good composer, though, yeah. Yeah, I don't remember the score, but like
that's my point. Yeah, usually yeah, I remember all right. The scores. Lord of the Rings,
that movie didn't work.
Terminator. Yeah.
Do you remember his score for the second Godzilla movie, where he actually brings in the themes from the Japanese movies?
I didn't, but I do remember the Blue Oyster Cult.
Oh, that was great, and I think my friends played on that too. I know Brendan played on that. I think Scott Ian played on that.
What band was it?
It was like a super group that Bear created. I'm gonna find that, because it's they covered the Blue Oyster Cult. Let's see, you can edit this out if you want.
We'll do it live. No,
do it, fuck it, do it live. Okay, let's see. So I want to get this right.
Oh, that Bear McQuarrie score.
It was sung by Serge Tankian from System of a Down. I don't want to mispronounce his name, but Tankian probably. So it's him and it's just so hard to Google this. Because it's like Godzilla cover. What?
What?
All right, here we go. Okay, so Bear McCreary. All right. Oh, for fuck's sake. You might have to edit this whole part out.
Yeah. If you can't find it, we can.
Oh, wait. Maybe here it is. Okay. Okay, yeah, no, it's Bear, it's Brendan, and Serge is singing.
Serge,
so it's,
wow.
Yeah, so it's mostly maybe Gene Hoagland did the drums. It's basically Death Clock with Serge singing. That's basically what it is.
Gotcha.
And Bear doing the arrangement. So, but that's the thing is, I remember when that exploded. I didn't even know that was happening, and then the end credits of that movie and that song exploded through, and I was just like, because it's always been an awesome song, and then to hear it that big and like with those big fuzzy metal guitars, it was fantastic.
Nice.
But anyway, so yeah, so going back to Chucky
is critic proof.
Well, he's critic proof, but also it does become that thing of the continuity of having it be Brad Dourif and Don Mancini, and always having the sort of gleefulness of Chucky to return to. Mm-hmm. It's like, even if you get caught up in the soap opera of the teenage characters or the Devon Sawa character or all the stuff with Fiona, the thing that I love about Fiona's performance is she gets to play two characters. Mm-hmm. You know, she even gets it. And if you watch the third season, she's practically playing a third character by that point.
Oh, wow. You know,
because she's playing the evolution of one of those characters, and it becomes that thing of like,
that's what part two was missing, because like the same kid comes back and he looks right. Like he doesn't want to be there compared to the first one where we're rooting for him to get out of peril. Mommy.
Well, and that's the weird thing too is, and we were talking about this the other day about how Catherine Hicks married Kevin Yeager, who was doing the effects
guy on and did you know that the eyes for the Crypt Keeper are Chucky's eyes?
Oh, I didn't know that. That makes a lot of sense, though. Kevin Yeager is a bit of a genius himself.
He's on Dads from the Crypt. You should check them out.
Yeah, that's great. But there was a moment when we did an episode of our show, when Scott Ian and I went to Tony Gardner's shop. Tony Gardner took over the Chucky effects with Seed of Chucky, and he's been doing them through the series. So he did Cult of Chucky. He did Curse of Chucky, Cult of Chucky, and now he does the series.
Oh, lovely.
And Tony described a moment where Fiona Dourif is looking at the Chucky doll and saying, oh, wow, this doll has my father's eyes. Wait a minute. I have my father's eyes. So this doll has my eyes. And I think casting Fiona might have been the best thing that that series could have done, because certainly Brad Dourif is going to show up for that, you know, those movies starring his daughter. But yeah. she's also like, she's great. And she brings that same level of a really committed, good actor applying that level of craft to these slasher movies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
what
she
get. I've always been a
fan. Yeah. Yeah, she's great. And she and a very sweet person in real life. And that sort of thing, that sort of quality of taking the uncommon level of quality and applying it to the thing that could coast on just being a B movie or could coast on just being an exploitation mm-hmm. movie. It is like, without defeating it, without elevating it, without making it not the thing that you would enjoy, those prurient, you know, I watch these movies for sex and death kind of qualities. It doesn't take away from that, but it does make everything better. It's like Kevin McCarthy starring in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Mm-hmm. You have a method actor who was a contemporary of Brando's being the lead in a horror movie.
At the second stage of his career, becoming a genre favorite now.
There you go. And that's the thing is that, like, when you find these actors like Brad Dourif, like Lance Henriksen, who, despite what they're showing up in, they're going to bring it all. You know, and now there's a new generation of people like that who are known as genre actors, and then they really show up and they commit no matter what the project is. You know, somebody like Doug Jones comes to mind, where it's like you feel like every time Doug is not buried under a creature suit for Guillermo del Toro, you can feel him taking the opportunity to really give a fully nuanced performance. I loved all the episodes he showed up on What We Do in the Shadows. And that to me is like, it's not just, hey, I'm a fan. It's also, it doesn't matter what the project is, I'm going to do my best work possible. And to me, that is contributing as a fan, because you care about the quality of the horror movie you're in. You're not just saying, oh, that's a horror movie. Oh, I'm doing this shit for the money. Jamie Lee Curtis in the new Halloween trilogy, whatever you say about that trilogy, Jamie Lee Curtis is showing up and playing the character like she would in any Oscar bait kind of movie. Mm-hmm. And there's something to that. People showing up for horror and really applying themselves as if it's a movie, not just a horror movie. You know?
Yeah.
That's why I think Chucky persists.
I mean, Chris Sarandon and Catherine Hicks take this material very serious. And
Chris Sarandon in Fright Night is like as good as any performance in any movie. That is like up there with him and Dog Day.
Everyone in Near Dark, just as good as
Near Dark. Oh my God. The bar scene in Near Dark is like one of those. I put that up there with Citizen Kane. It's so brilliant. It's like that sequence is like burned into my, it's like the train station scene in The Untouchables and the bar scene in Near Dark.
Oh, there you go. That is quite a list.
Pure cinema, pure cinema. The match cut in Lawrence of Arabia and the bar scene in Near Dark.
Arabia. Now that is 5,000 stars. That's a good one. So
that's, I got, but the, it's so, I mean, big, I can't put it on my shelf. I've got the.
So, out of all the moments, the very first Child's Play, I think just like the electricity, it's so electrical.
Well, that thing I mentioned, the audience, the sound the audience made when they realized that the doll was real, and it was like a noise, kind of like this, like, oh, like it was like, oh wow, and
right.
There's something to that. When there's something to.
And it lands a punch, however it's coordinated.
It lands a punch.
You actually feel like he's terrorizing our, you know, detective while he's driving away in his car. I love the whole gotcha, I'm not dead yet finale in the apartment, because any other movie would just go on too long or just make you realize how formulaic it is. And it's just the right amount of genre expectations with a few shocks and then knowing how to get done on time.
And I love that there was an era of filmmaker that I kind of feel like filmmakers these days are lucky if they get the opportunity to do this. Mm-hmm. But there was an era of filmmakers who literally said,
they let them play with their toys.
And let's take the risk.
Let's take the risk.
Ridley Scott took an actor who had never been in a movie before. She got cut out of Annie Hall, but otherwise had never been in a movie before. And he put her in the cast of his movie Alien, his big giant alien movie.
Sigourney Weaver, yeah.
And he said, everyone's going to think that Tom Skerritt's going to be the hero. Everyone's going to see all these other actors and imagine that they're going to live. And instead, the one actor that no one's seen before is the only one that's going to survive. And it's going to work because she's spellbound.
Before we did it with Scream, where the famous person dies in the start.
That's right. But also, Scream is riffing off of Psycho. Yeah. It's like the most famous person gets killed off. I'm talking the person no one has seen before is going to be the only one that we can root for. And the balls on that guy to risk that whole thing. And he was right. She's amazing. She's a spellbinding actor.
She knew.
And so that ability to risk, it's like, listen, people are going to freak out when it turns out that this doll is alive. Let's freak them out. This is going to be great.
Let's do it.
So I do feel like a lot of movies these days that are made by committee, it's like, you can either see where they're going or they go in 14 different directions every step of the way. So they never feel like anything. We're missing the kind of filmmaking where we're building up to a moment. And I think it's kind of gotten turned into twist filmmaking, you know, very Shyamalan, very, very riffing off The Sixth Sense, where it's like, we're building to the twist. It's like, don't build to the twist, build to the turn.
And the turn of events, not the chain.
Exactly. The turn is that the doll is alive. And that changes everything. It's not the twist of like, you didn't see that coming. That's the turn. The doll's alive.
They do have good ideas, even when they're not realized. Like, part two has some interesting set design and commentary on Chucky, the abusive doll, is able to kill the abuser. Part three, I wish those Marines he was terrorizing could have been more like the ones in Aliens, where
part three is dark as fuck. He basically manipulates a bunch of teenagers into shooting each other with real bullets.
Yeah,
that is so dark. I watched the third one with my buddies in a garage, and we were all just, you know, drinking and laughing and talking over it. And I remember shitting on that movie the whole time. Cut to this past Halloween, and Liesl and I watch it together, and I'm like, this one's actually, it's dark, but I enjoyed it as much as Child's Play 2. And I kind of feel like pound for pound, there's not a dog in the series. Like, it definitely does swings. It gets more campy for Bride of Chucky and then fully campy for Seed of Chucky. And it gets meta and it does all these fold ends on themselves. But when you get right down to it, watching all that stuff back to back, that's a consistently entertaining series. And I think part of it is because if you want to take it seriously, I mean, it's gory and all the things you want from a horror movie. If you want to say, no, this is silly, you can just laugh at it. And it kind of rides that line throughout the entire series. Even when it gets campy and meta, it invests it. You know, you kind of get in Chucky season two, you kind of get invested in the Glenn and Glenda of it all. You know, that it even though it's ridiculous,
he could be an Ed Wood creation if you think about it.
Yeah. No, and that's the other crazy thing too, is like Don Mancini finding a way to bring in what influenced him. And one of the things that influenced him was Ed Wood. I got to tell you, man, because like, think about any other series like that, you know, certainly not Texas Chainsaw.
That goes certainly off the rails and people can't even take any kind of serious.
Or like Friday 13th. The Friday 13th movies have like a weird duology through them where they kind of have a call and response.
Worse than the Star Trek, even an odd role. It's like, what? This is my personal trilogy. This is my
personal trilogy. So in my cut of the Galaxy Quest doc, over the end credits, we have Scott Nance saying, Galaxy Quest is owned by Paramount?
Yes.
They could make a box set of Star Trek and Galaxy Quest is in there. And then you see him figure it out. He goes, wait, when did Galaxy Quest come out? Okay, it came out in 99. It came out after Star Trek Insurrection and before Star Trek Nemesis. Oh my God. Galaxy Quest is the even-numbered Star Trek movie that throws off the whole curve, mm-hmm. because Insurrection is bad, and then Galaxy Quest is great, and then Nemesis is bad, and then the original J.J. Abrams Star Trek is great, and then Into Darkness is bad, and then Star Trek Beyond is good. And you're like, and he goes through and he does the math. Now, of course, you can make the argument that none of the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies are any good. But, and you could also make the argument that Nemesis and Insurrection are underrated. But I love that.
Even Star Trek 3. But yeah, it is interesting how the odds and evens.
Yeah, Star Trek 3 was one that I used to shit on, and revisiting it recently, I'm like, oh, this it feels like an episode of a TV show. It's as good as any of them. So yeah, I mean, I feel that way about a lot of series where what are you looking for? The first three Nightmare on Elm Street movies are in very distinctly different ways, like mm-hmm. a kind of horror masterpiece. And then three is so great that every movie after it is just remaking three until New Nightmare.
Yep.
So you look at that, and then you look at like the Jason movies where it's like there's one and two, and then
only as good as whatever the tone is that time.
Yeah, it's kind of like let's make seven more like four. Let's make, you know, six more like two. And, you know, like they kind of have a call and response.
Let's have them fight a Carrie knockoff. Let's have them become the Terminator finally.
Yeah, exactly. Let's have him breathe real hard and have the shoulders move up and down. I think that was a Kane choice. No, anyway, it's things like that where it's things like that. I love that. Kane's like, I'm wearing a hockey mask. I got nothing but my physicality. I'll just have him be breathing really hard. And it's he's right. It's menacing. He like sits there. I don't want a guy built like that, you know, looking like he's revving up to charge me. He's breathing out really hard.
So, all I can do to inject persona.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so I had the absolute pleasure of directing Chucky, not an episode of the TV series, but I got to direct Chucky the Doll, because we had Brad Dourif record lines for our show for Blood and Guts with Scott Ian, which we used to do mm-hmm. as an online show, and you can find that episode on YouTube. And I have this recording of Brad Dourif's audio, and it was just for basically a promo thing.
And this was after you had worked for the Associated Press and
Long Learning Channel. Yeah. Yeah, because all that stuff is what I did on the East Coast. I did
videography and journalism.
Yeah, like I remember for the TLC thing, I was sent into the suburbs of Roanoke, Virginia, basically with a camera to shoot footage of Virginian women, like older women living in Virginia who were really excited about the royal wedding, which I think at that point was it wasn't Harry and me and Meghan Markle yet. It was
previous.
Yeah. It was. Oh man, I'm blank. I don't.
The guys who came before them.
Exactly. So yeah. So that was like something I did where, and it was really nice because it was these, you know, little old ladies who were Virginia ladies who were dressed up for a tea party because they were so excited about the royal wedding. So like that was, I did gigs like that. I would drive to West Virginia and shoot stuff for the AP. I would drive to Georgia, you know, when the bigger, it was just something where like I was doing any gig that I could when I was still living in Southwest Virginia that was related to making movies. So I did all that stuff then. I wrote for the Roanoke Times. I wrote, I started writing for Fangoria when I was still living in Virginia. And then in 2011, I moved to Los Angeles. So there's sort of like a demarcation line of me doing all of that stuff and finding any way to do anything related to media. And those were like camera jobs and editing jobs that I would do freelance. And then I was also making my own movies and gaining a reputation as a DIY filmmaker. And I could have done that. I could have done that forever. I could have stayed in Southwest Virginia, but I wanted to see what happened if I threw my hat in the ring and came out here to LA and you know, see what happens when I come to a bigger market. And that led directly to me meeting Scott Ian on the first day of our show. And Scott's just been a gift to my career ever since. And, and a good friend too. And when we got to meet Chucky, like that became that moment where, because Brad Dourif recorded the lines, it felt like meeting Chucky. You know, it's like, there he is. It's really Chucky. And there's a guy doing the animatronics, but it's still Brad Dourif's voice saying lines to Scott and making references to I'm the Man. And I have this recording of Brad Dourif doing the lines, investing it as if it was one of the movies, like not even skimping at all on the performance. And then there's a break where he says, and I'm going to perform, this is what it sounded like. Okay, so this is Brad Dourif on the recording. Well, can we pull something from the library? Well, I've done it so many times. No, I mean, it's like, do I have to do it now? Or is there something? No, listen, I'll do it. I'm just saying if I don't have to, because I don't want to, like, I want to blow my voice out or anything. No, no, of course, I'll do it. I'll do it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, okay. And that's the recording. It was him having, it was one side of the conversation with like an engineer or somebody saying, do I have to do the laugh? And I have this piece of audio, but he did it. And he did the Chucky laugh for us. And then in our episode, you hear it, you hear the Chucky laugh with, as, like I said, as invested as in any of the movies.
That's
so
lovely.
So God bless you, Brad Dourif. And I thanked him in person, and I thanked Fiona. And when I met her, and it's just one of those things of like, thanks for showing up for our silly little web series that we were doing about practical effects. So
that's lovely.
So I feel a specific pride that even though I haven't, when I say I've directed Chucky, I don't mean the show, but I have gotten the opportunity to direct Chucky.
Well, and the fact that he gave you his time, he gave it his all, and
what a guy.
He gave you a warning before impacting the verbal bullet that was his voice.
That's right. There was preamble to it.
You sure? Yeah. All right, no turning back.
And he's such a terrific actor. I'd love the opportunity to work with him in live action and actually
still
get to
time.
Direct him. And well, absolutely. And Fiona too. Like Fiona is there's actually a feature.
Is that
there
a recurring TV gigs? I think she'll.
Sure.
I mean, she was some of the other movies too.
She's on a cast list for Something I Want to Do. I think she is an underrated actor, and her being known so much for Chucky, it's like, you know, she's good enough that she could do anything. So
the only connection I had to this franchise is I worked with the actor who played the priest in Curse of Chucky, A. Martinez.
Oh, hey.
He was
right
an
on.
Extra. I was an extra on this show he was on, Queen of the South. But it was just interesting because he was schooling this extra who he was going to beat up as a crooked sheriff for two episodes. And I'm like, it was a very open set compared to most sets, which are going to say, hey, get away from me, kid. You know, you shouldn't be talking to me the time. But I just love how he's mentoring this guy and finding the idea of how to stage this. I'm like, see, that's cool. That's commitment. That's mentoring. That's awesome. Because I see so many other people who are.
That's great.
There were so many other people who weren't happy to be on that show. So it was just cool to see someone who's like, hey, good, bad, going to do the best. I'm going to be the brightest star in that room. So.
Well, and You mentioned Ray Wise earlier, and it's like that those character actors who seem just happy to be there and seem happy to be working, but then in a way that they're setting the tone for the set because they're coming in and they're like, you know, if they're professional and they bring their positivity to it
instead of just letting everyone get them down. It's like, hey.
Well, it's like people at conventions who give everybody a hard time. It's like those are the people who are hanging on to the thing that they did versus the people who just really like doing it and they really like showing up. And, you know, A. Martinez, like, he's been on Dark Winds and, you know, he's got a nice, vibrant career.
That is a good show.
Yeah. And he's a good actor. And it's that kind of thing of like, so there's a guy who didn't have to give somebody his time and then did because he probably remembers how hard it is, you know, for himself. And
I think because he's consistently worked, he's always been fortunate enough to be one of those guys to not be overshadowed by any other thing. And I get it. There's so many of these actors who you see, hey, you know, because I made it, I don't have to brush up on my acting anymore. So I might potentially, you know, get worse as an actor the more famous I get. And then there's other ones who just always have a cool routine. They have gotten it through their thick head that, you know, in addition to fame and fortune, you are still representing a business brand and you got to keep marketing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And people who think of themselves as a franchise or people who are less interested in.
Get along with everybody now as opposed to never.
Right. That's right. And that's the other thing, too. We're all going to be around for a long time.
Hey,
so
this director did a good job, but he doesn't get this show or me or anyone else. So let's get rid of him after this season.
Well, but then also it's like, who do you work well with? And some people, you know, some people are really toxic.
6-hour days are great. 12-hour days, not so much.
some people are really toxic and they like being surrounded by toxic people because then they feel better about how toxic they are.
Insecurity.
And you're like, stay away from that set. And then, but all it takes is one, all it takes is one asshole to sink a set. But that's why that thing you said about the good team, it's like, I have the people that I really like working with. And then I love working with new people and, you know, seeing what happens when I bring somebody new into the mix.
I'm glad no one has shat on your parade.
Well, I mean, they have, like, pretty,
but not to the point where you're just like, I disown half this shit I've been working on for this particular era, you know?
I feel like a big part of your job as somebody who's navigating this topsy-turvy crazy business is you got to constantly be in a state of remembering that we're all doing this because we didn't want to do an office job. We're all doing this because the whatever shape that we are, it doesn't fit into this peg. It fits into this peg, you know, it doesn't. So if I'm a square peg, you know, I got to find a square, square hole to push myself through, basically. And that kind of, that feeling of like, any opportunity I get, I'm lucky to get. And also, I'm not going to pretend that I don't deserve it because I worked very hard for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also am only going to be in positions of saying, this is great. I get to make movies. This is great. You know, anytime I get to work, this is great, you know? And I've done a couple of jobs just for money that, you know, have been kind of hard because the only thing carrying me through is like, oh, I got to get that paycheck. But never in the creative space. That's only been in the sort of film worker space, you know, in the crew member space, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whenever I've gotten the job to direct, I always sleep better that night. I always go home feeling great because, you know, even when it was stuff that was as easy to direct as like the concert films I did, basically what I got to do was a lot of prep and then watch a concert. and you know, I still did all the posts and everything too. And my voice is definitely in even those movies. And certainly my sensibilities are. And my amazing DP, Mike Mogadam, who shot both of those concert films, that's his work all over the place.
Yep.
And it's what we're passionate about. And I love the bands. But at the end of the day, it's sort of like, my job was the easy part.
Yep.
My job was to show up and be the audience member who happened to have all these cameras. You know, when I get that opportunity, that's whether I deserve it or not, it's only good fortune to be able to do that kind of job.
Yep.
Yeah. And I remember that. I got to remember that, you know. I stoke the flame of being, you mentioned before something about creators who are fans. We all started as fans.
Yes, we did.
And we move into creating because, you know, what else were we going to do?
It was definitely not anything else. That was the typical generic expectation.
Yeah.
And kudos to Chucky for doing the same thing. You know,
no one has encouraged me to make movies in my life except the movies, you know, seeing movies.
There are icons for a reason.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, just like all our heroes are dead, all our icons are fictional.
Well, some
all
of
our best friends
are
on screen.
some of my heroes and best friends are in real life, and that's
I know. But and just, there's always someone that is bigger than life because of how well that fiction is rooted.
Well, I'll tell you what, man, Harry Dean Stanton, maybe my favorite actor of all time. He was a giant on screen, and then I met him, and even though he was a little old man when I met him, he was a giant in person too. So
oh, nice.
And so is Sigourney, and so is all the people I've had the pleasure of meeting. I to this day have not had a disappointing experience meeting one of the people who inspired me.
It's lovely, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And now that I've said that, it'll happen tomorrow.
Okay, let's count on it.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, man.
Absolutely. You have glammed up the place. this rocket ship never stopped firing on all cylinders, so that's great.
I don't remember anything I said. Will you send it to me?
Totally.
Thanks. Do you sign off or anything, or are we?
Yeah,
done?
No, I'll sign off for you. But thank you ever so much for just giving an expose in your show. Just any tips and tricks before we go on just how anyone can get involved, because I see so many people. They're afraid to even do the simplest things, like look at a YouTube tutorial and established their own formula, shot list guy, shot script guy, storyboard guy, you know, just come up with ideas, enter a contest instead of just lying around complaining, I could do that, but don't follow up.
You're hitting the nail on the head. And I can only speak from my experience. And my experience is I was living in Southwest Virginia. When I went to school, there was no film program at the school at the time. It was film analysis classes, but there were no film production. There was one film production class taught by an amazing guy named Jerry Sheeler, who's no longer with us and who was, you know, one of the big influences on my life. And then the other film professor was Stephen Prince, who's also no longer with us. And you can hear him on a bunch of Kurosawa Criterion Blu-rays. And he wrote the book on Kurosawa. He wrote the book on Sam Peckinpah as well. Oh, and so those guys were influences on me and taught me a lot. And Jerry in particular taught me a lot about approaching art. But also Jerry taught me that the best way to learn is to do it. And I started doing it. And like I said, there was no money and nobody was encouraging me. Nobody was saying, hey, this is a great idea. You should make movies. And I, in 1998, started my first real attempt to make a feature film. And I started making that movie in 1999. It was that long ago. And I started shooting it with volunteer actors, people from the theater department. 21
years old when you did that.
There you go. I was 21 years old making my first movie. And it's almost done.
Sweet.
Any day now, I'm going to finish that
film. Any day now.
But seriously, I made a movie and it didn't really work. So I said, this can't be the last movie I made. So I made another movie. That one worked better, but I made new mistakes. So I made a third movie to make up for the mistakes of the second one. And I kept doing that until today. You know, like it just has continued. That has been the beginning of my career. By my fourth or fifth movie, I was getting into local film festivals. By my eighth movie, I was getting into international film festivals. And now here I am. And I just had a movie play at the Chinese Theater. I just had a short that I directed, A Good Scream, play at a Chinese Theater. And that's a movie that I produced with the lead actress, Fina Sanchez, who also wrote it. And that started with, I read her script that she wrote. And I said, hey, I'd like to make this movie. And she was like, really? And then that turned us making this movie that has had this festival run. And she's brilliant in the movie. And everybody who sees it is talking about how great she is. And that's like, that just started with me saying, hey, I like your script. I want to make this movie. And that, I think it's as easy as that. You can't expect the reward to be that. You can't be like, you know, Fina winning a Best Actress award at one of the fests, or us winning a Best Short award at one of the fests, you know, things like that. That's not the reason why we did it. And it's wonderful that that happened. But the reason we did it is because we wanted to do it. We wanted to make a movie and not wait for someone to say, now you get to make a movie. So it's not about the reward. It's about the doing it. And if you really want to do it,
bingo,
find a way to do it.
The bigger picture. I love it.
And that's what I did with a borrowed standard def camera shooting on mini DV all the way back in 1999. And then I come out here to LA and there are a handful of people did the exact same thing. My buddy Josh Miller made a movie like that with the exact same camera that I used. And his movie that he made back then with his writing partner, Pat Casey, just got released on Blu-ray.
Sweet.
In the wake of the success that they've enjoyed as the writers of the Sonic the Hedgehog movies and Violent Night. So those guys started out there in the Midwest making a movie with the Canon XL1, the same mini DV camera that I was using at Virginia Tech to make my first movie. So this is not just my story. This is people who are creative, and that you can't stop their creativity. You find the way. You find the way to make a movie, and then every movie is an experience you learn from.
And hopefully there are memories you always bring up time and again instead of just being like, well, it happened, you know.
Oh, yeah. My
check cleared. Next.
Exactly. My California-born girlfriend, I have shown her all of my Virginia movies, and often wistfully. It's like, I remember this. I remember that. In this movie is a location that doesn't exist anymore. And I have a record of it because I filmed in it, you know, at that time, things like that.
Nice.
So, yeah. That's the only advice I have is listen, nobody's stopping you but yourself. And if you think the only way you can make a movie is by other people giving you a lot of money to make the movie with, I got great advice for you. Start right now with no money. Find a camera, even if it's on your phone. Good Lord, the technology is amazing now. You can, on your phone, replicate like really sophisticated camera lenses, and you can get really good audio. And my buddy Buzz Wallach does a thing called Just Scare Me out here in LA, and he was shooting on his iPhone. And they look beautiful, these movies. And we did a couple of those. Our mutual friend Andrew Cash directed one that I'm in with my girlfriend Liesl. And he just came over to my apartment and shot it with his iPhone. And it looks beautiful. It looks, you know, it's not even, yeah. What I'm trying to say is, yeah, we all want to make movies with the Alexa and anamorphic lenses. But if you don't have that, make it with your phone. There's no excuse not to try to make a movie. So.
Well, and that's just it. I see so many, they're like, if I had this many million dollars, is like, well, here's the thing. You still got to be able to compensate for everything, because if you're going to just use money to cover up your mistakes, then you're really not suited for this. And I just see so many of that saying, I can't do that without this. I'm like, yes, you can.
There are so many good movies that were made for not enough money that you realize that no movie ever has enough money. That's one. Two, not enough money is not an excuse for not a good movie. Unless the only reason you're watching movies is to see things that are expensive.
Bingo. And this is it.
Yeah.
It's ultimately, if it's being used to cover up an already just non-existent plot, then you're already in the wrong business.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I don't know. Like I said, I like all kinds of movies. And I like to watch all kinds of
movies. You do? No, just kidding.
And that includes movies where there's no plot. I don't know if I'm going to sit there and watch all of Andy Warhol's Skyscraper, but I'm just saying, there's a lot of different kinds
of
movies.
We all set our limits.
We do all set our limits, to each their own.
With further ado, always a delight. You're welcome back anytime. Mode anything.
Thanks so much.
But be safe out there, and don't let any of the political, social, or disease troubles of the world get you down.
That's good advice for all of us, man. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Yes, live long and prosper.
Yep, I'm doing it with both hands.
If I grab Thor's hammer, what a savings.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
Jack Bennett, leave.
Jack Bennett, leave.
I want my fucking phone call.
You gotta be in like a horror movie as a guy who kills slasher, or you gotta be in an action movie. Jack Bennett.
I drive a Toyota Matrix, and my buddy told me, you realize that your car is a Commando reference, because I'm Bennett and it's Matrix. Bennett.
There
and Matrix.
You go, man.
Let
all
off
comes
some
around.
Steam, Bennett.
That's all some steam.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a